You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 19. Hello and welcome to today's show. Today we're talking all about dyslexia. Now, I'm not at all proud to say that before I had this conversation with this specialist dyslexia tutor, Debbie Abraham, I actually had no idea what dyslexia actually was. I went all the way through my teacher training and through my teaching career without ever being told what it was, and I never took the trouble to find out. But in this episode, Debbie is giving us the complete lowdown on dyslexia. So she answers questions like, what is dyslexia? What kinds of tasks children find difficult when they have dyslexia? What are the signs that your child might be dyslexic? How to cope if your school is in dyslexia denial and they're saying that your child doesn't have it and you are pretty convinced that they do? And then lots of other questions to do with dyslexia and supporting your dyslexic child. So I think this episode is actually really important for everybody to listen to, whether you have a dyslexic child or not, because it will give you greater empathy and understanding for dyslexic people in your life and help you to see the really good sides of their personality as well as the things that they struggle with academically. So I'm going to take you straight over to the interview. Enjoy. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Debbie Abraham.
Hi, really glad to be here, Lucy. Thanks for asking me on.
It's fantastic to have you, Debbie. So I'm going to dive in first with the very first question, because as a teacher, I was never taught the answer to this question through my teacher training and through all my teaching career. I never really understood. But what is dyslexia?
Oh, that is an excellent question, Lucy, and really not very well understood at all. Mm-hmm. But it is basically a language problem. If you always start from that point, it is a problem with language. And it's thought that a dyslexic child actually processes words and sounds slightly out of rhythm to the rest of us, which actually means that they hear them in a very slightly different way. So, and they can also, it's things like they find it very difficult to recall words from their kind of visual memories as well. So it's a language problem, but it's also a problem with recall. And it's also a problem with making certain skills automatic. So for example, when you read, you're not really looking at the words and thinking, oh, what letters are there? What sounds do they make? How do I put them together? Because your brain has made that skill automatic. In a dyslexic child, it's not automatic. They're okay. Having to really think about it. They have problems with knowing which sounds go with which letters as well. Mm-hmm. And it can also be quite a verbal problem. They may have problems actually splitting words up verbally into their different sounds as well. So knowing, for example, that the word sheep is sh-e-p. So what I'm really saying to you is you've got to get away from thinking that it's a reading problem. Mm-hmm. It can show up as a reading problem, but it's actually a language problem.
Okay, so my question there is, what is going on in the brain of a dyslexic person that is different from like somebody like me who doesn't have those problems?
Okay, well, we know from MRI scans that when a dyslexic child reads, that the areas of the brain that a fluent reader uses are not being used. So in actual fact, a lot of their pathways are quite different. And what that really means is that for them to become a fluent reader, we need to teach them how to map sounds onto letters, for example, because that enables the brain to put a new pathway in place. And then once they've had that teaching, then under an MRI scan, we know that the same areas of the brain get highlighted up when they read, you know, once they've had an appropriate intervention.
What's it? So you can teach them to use the bits of the brain that they should be using, but they weren't using, by using, yes, the right kind of teaching techniques.
Yes, exactly.
That's
that.
Fascinating. So
it is.
It's almost like the brain doesn't know how to use itself.
Well, I think you have to remember that, you know, we've not always been reading. I mean, reading is a relatively modern thing
that we all do. Population, yeah,
exactly. And so it's not exactly, you know, if you think in terms of evolution, it's not really something we've been doing very much. And reading obviously suits certain people very well, mm-hmm. And in fact most of the population. But it's thought that in evolutionary terms, a lot of we have sort of what we now know as dyslexic people, because in fact they do think quite differently to okay. others. And in evolutionary times, it's actually quite important to have people that can make different connections, that can think outside the box. It's the only way that humanity actually moves forward. So it's now thought that that's why you have sort of this 10% of the population who effectively think a little bit differently. And if you think about some of the entrepreneurs out there that have been the disruptors,
Branson.
Richard Branson, I'm pretty certain that Steve Jobs, okay. he was either dyslexic or he had ADHD, he had something. Jamie Oliver.
Yes.
You know, there are a number of people who have come in and sort of disrupted their own industries, and they are dyslexic. They are people who make different connections. They think differently. Their brains do actually work slightly differently. And obviously, when we are at school, our academic subjects really want you to be able to think in a certain way and to mm-hmm. be able to do certain skills, which most of the population can do. Probably 80-90% of the population are able to do, but the other 10% need to have certain specialist teaching really to enable their brains to make the neural pathways so that they can become like fluent readers too. But of course there is an argument, isn't there, that maybe the 80-90% of the population needs to have certain specialist teaching so that they can think outside the box.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. No, it's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Because, yeah, people do have, the people who have different ways of looking at problems or, you know, are just able to see things in a different way are often the people who make breakthroughs where other people have got stuck. And it's really interesting, you know, thinking about Richard Branson and Jamie Oliver in that kind of context, you know, as disruptors, but in a very, very positive and innovative way. So in another episode, it's with Zoe Short, who's the mother of an Asperger's child, and she also worked with in special needs in further education. She was like, you should always look for the positive in your child with special educational needs, and you know, what do they do well? And I think that's what you're kind of saying from a different kind of way, isn't it? That actually look at the positives about how their mind works and what they bring to the world that's different from the rest of the population.
Absolutely. I think this is the part that's really missing at the moment, especially from schools and their everyday lives. You know, these children have got a lot of things to bring. They are often very, you know, exceptionally good at certain things. I mean, when I think about just the students that I teach, in the past I've had a gymnast who basically might make it onto the British team.
Wow.
In the future. I've got a very, very talented singer who at the moment is sort of trying to forge a bit of a career. I mean, she's only 12, 13, mm-hmm. And is absolutely an amazing singer. I've got others who play, you know, rugby, sort of top sort of county level for their ages.
Wow.
So, you know, these are very talented individuals, and, you know, you just have to try, you have to view the whole person.
Yes.
View what they're like as an individual. And, you know, if you can sort of bring out to them that they are actually out of the box thinkers, that they do make different connections, that you know, they can sort of view things spatially much better than other people can. And it's sort of important to push them, I suppose, in the directions of things that they're good at, rather than constantly sort of thinking that what they're not so good at, you know.
Trying to make up for the weaknesses rather than celebrating the strengths.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. You should always celebrate the strengths first. And also, I was chatting to a lady the other day who She's very interesting for me to talk to. She has a PhD. She's also dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And to ask her, you know, what were the most the key things for her? And she said, you know, you've got to remind these people that once they're out of sort of primary, secondary school, especially, you can use technology. Yeah. You know, this is actually not a bad time for people who struggle with the basics of reading and writing and spelling, because actually there's a lot of technology out there now that can help you with that. And what are we actually going to pay you for? Are we, you know, if you think about industry, do we pay someone because they can spell a word correctly anymore?
No. The only people who are paid for their spelling is proofreaders.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, everybody else is more interested in what ideas can you come up with? How good are you? You know, if you're a 3D spatial thinker, which a large number of dyslexic children are, you know, if you want to be an architect, you're going to be absolutely amazing at that job.
Yeah. So one thing I just want to come back to that you said right at the very beginning was that it's a language problem. And you said something about how children struggle to process even spoken language. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, not so much. There's a lot of research going on at the moment. A lady involved in it is a lady called Professor Goswami. Mm-hmm. And she's looking at rhythm. Language has a rhythm to it. And dyslexic children's brains don't process the language to the same rhythm as we speak it. You know, the actual timing. The timing is slightly out. And because the timing is slightly out, it means that they're just hearing words very slightly differently. So if you're thinking that, you know, language is partly sound-based, I mean, written language is partly sound-based. It's not completely sound-based, but, you know, it's a large part of it. So if you've got an unknown word in front of you, you know, most of us will look at it and we'll start splitting the words up into different sounds so that we can think about what that word actually is. Whereas a dyslexic child won't have that way into it because they won't necessarily understand what sounds go with those letters. And because they're hearing sounds slightly differently to the rest of us, you know, it's quite hard for them to make the connections between, oh, we mean that sound with that set of letters.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, a bit, yeah. I think it's really complicated, isn't it? It's like, you know, that question that people often say, you know, if I see blue, does everybody else see blue in the same way that I see blue? And I suppose it's like, do you hear language in the same way that I hear language?
Exactly. That's exactly it. It's the equivalent of that. So, of course, if you're learning phonics, for example, then if you're not hearing it quite the same way, then it's going to take you longer to learn it. And, of course, the other thing with dyslexia, the other component, bit large component of it, is they have something called a poor working memory. Mm-hmm. Now, working memory is your brain's ability to juggle lots of different processes at the same time. So when you're reading a word, for example, you've got to recognize the shape of the letters, you've got to come up with the sound that that letter makes, then you've got to think about how do we pronounce that whole word, because obviously pronunciation comes into it as well, and then you've got to come up with the word. So you've got at least sort of four or five brain processes going on. Well, a child with dyslexia generally can juggle two or three.
Okay.
So if you throw that into the mix.
Okay, it makes it really, so they might get through like the first two steps then start to struggle and, you know, they start
get
to
lost.
Fall down then. Okay, that's really interesting because my five-year-old is learning, he's in year one now and he's, you know, getting through the phonics and all that kind of thing and watching him learn to read. I can imagine just how frustrating it would be for a child who, you know, had that kind of impairment, I suppose, of not being able to put all those steps together. And, you know, watching him, it's quite slow sometimes, and it is watching the cogs turn in his head. And I'm pretty sure he's not dyslexic, but, you know, I can just imagine how frustrating it is for both the children and the parents in that situation where there is dyslexia.
Absolutely. No, it's highly frustrating. And the thing with phonics, it's brilliant that phonics is now taught in schools, because obviously for a period of time it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So it's excellent that it is done, but it's done at such a fast speed that if you've got a child that needs longer to learn it, then actually they struggle, they get left behind on it. So although it is the right method, it's the right kind of thinking behind how to help children to read, it sort of falls down for a dyslexic child because it's actually too fast.
Is it just that it's too fast, or is it that they're kind of skipping steps that dyslexic children need in order for that information, you know, to set up those neural pathways in their brain?
I mean you have to, when we teach the dyslexic children, or when I teach them the sounds and the letters, you're having to make it what we call multisensory. So you're trying to get, you know, to use the looking, the hearing, and like the movement kind of into the learning. And I guess when they're learning phonics at school, they're not actually employing a completely multisensory way of learning as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think maybe technique plus speed. Isn't helping.
Yeah, just there. A few episodes ago, I interviewed Joanna Grace about how to use the senses for deeper and better learning. And her speciality is working with very disabled children and using the senses to help them to understand the world around them. But she kind of brought that into, you know, like children in mainstream education. And I think, you know, what you're talking about in using more of the senses, it very much chimes in with what she was saying. So that's episode 15 for anybody listening who'd like to go back and listen to that one as well. Okay, Debbie, let's move on a bit, because I think I kind of get what dyslexia actually is, kind of at the level of the brain now. So if a parent is worried that their child might be dyslexic, what are the signs that, you know, that is the case?
Okay, so in actual fact, some of the signs can show up pretty early on in life. Mm-hmm. Things to watch out for is if your child has a speech and language problem identified at quite a young age, doesn't mean they will definitely have dyslexia, because there can be other reasons why they might not be able to speak properly, but it's definitely a first kind of like warning bell that should start ringing. Also, if your child could never clap in time to nursery rhymes, could never march in time, that's another very, very early, just warning bell. Not, you know, definitely, but a warning bell. I think with dyslexia, you have to sort of, you're looking at the whole picture. So there's not one thing that you'd say, oh, if this child has this one thing, they're definitely dyslexic. But you're looking at, well, okay, so if they couldn't clap in a rhythm, if they've gone on and they've had real problems learning phonics at school, and then if you're trying to teach them their spellings, like their spelling homework, and they sort of seem to know the spelling that day that they do it, but the next day they can't remember any of them. Okay. You're starting to see like a trail, if you like, a little trail of breadcrumbs. It's like leading you down a road. Think, hang on, something's not right here. So in a child that's at school, the most obvious one, although I say it's not a reading problem, but it is the most obvious sign that they're having struggling, you know, they're struggling to read. They're not learning their phonics. Excuse me. They're having difficulty learning their spellings. Mm-hmm. In an older child, it will be things like verbally, they can explain, you know, quite complex concepts to you. Mm-hmm. And then when it's written down, you might get two or three sentences that may make sense. So it's a real mismatch between what they can tell you verbally and what they can actually write down.
Okay, so that's what you might be looking for in kind of a more teenage child than a young child, is it?
Yeah, like a sort of later primary school and throughout secondary school.
Okay, so what is the earliest you think that dyslexia can be diagnosed? Because I've heard many a teacher say it's too early to say whether they're dyslexic or not, particularly in the first few years at primary school.
Yeah, I mean, the accepted age is age 7. It seems to be some arbitrary age that, in my opinion, has just been picked out of the air. Because I think by then, They feel that some of the issues that might be down to development should be kind of overcome by the age of seven. But I would say that if you have a younger child, if you have somebody like a close relative that's been identified as dyslexic, and you have a child in preschool who simply cannot clap to a rhythm to save their life, I would say start to implement a dyslexia reading program at that age to catch them as early as possible. Nobody will tell you for certain that that child has dyslexia, but in my opinion, if you start to teach them as if they might be, then if they turn out to be, they'll be a lot further down the road to remediation than if you let them struggle, 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 struggle till they're seven, and then they're already probably a year behind. And at seven, they already know they're behind. They are very aware that they're reading different books to their classmates. So you're already going to be starting to deal with self-esteem and self-confidence issues. So in my opinion, if anything is even vaguely suspected from the absolute early stage, even a child that's having difficulty picking up phonics, just take them out. Give them a dyslexia, specialist intervention, which all schools should have. Just start using it, because then the child just simply won't fall so far behind. And even if they turn out not to be dyslexic, well, it won't really matter, because it's improving their skills
Okay,
and
yeah, I was going to
improve.
ask that. Could a dyslexia specific reading program damage a child who doesn't have dyslexia? Or
No,
is.
not at all. No, they might just find it in the end a little bit slow. That's about it.
Okay, so most of the people listening to this program, this episode, are going to be thinking about teenagers and secondary school students. So, if dyslexia hasn't been diagnosed at primary school, but they're still kind of having problems and you're beginning to wonder if there's something deeper going on, what are the signs and really what should a parent do about it? Particularly if they're coming up to exams like GCSEs or A levels.
Yeah, and it's surprising how often actually that's still the case that people aren't diagnosed before that time. So, for example, when a child is reading the text, they might really struggle on multi-syllable words. They just can't read them properly. And you might kind of think, oh, that's a bit strange, or oh, that's a bit sweet. They muddle up some of the syllables, or they miss some of the syllables out. But actually, it's not sweet, and it's not sort of like a cute thing. They should not be doing that. They should be able to read, words of sort of four, five syllables. They should be able to read without a problem. But if you have dyslexia, then generally they can't. Look
So
at them
that's
writing.
like if that's every word in a text that goes beyond three syllables that they're struggling with, or is it just the odd word that they're struggling with? What's the kind of frequency, and or does that give an indication of the severity of the dyslexia, like the frequency of this problem in the reading?
If it's not been picked up by the time they're at secondary school, and especially leading up to GCSEs, then you're not going to be dealing with anything that's very severe. You're going to be dealing with something that is slightly milder, that they're probably those kids that are kind of just struggling. They might be hovering around the sort of just below the pass mark, the old D grades. I think that's what's that, two or a three now in the
Yeah, so a
numbers.
four is a basic pass, so a three would be the equivalent of a D grade.
So it's those children that are kind of struggling, and if you notice that they can't read any multi-syllable words, so words over three syllables, if they struggle with those, that I would say should start ringing some bells. If they don't understand what they read, I mean, school's very good at checking, can children bark out the words? Okay, but they're really poor at checking that they actually understand what they read. So any kind of comprehension issues, another big warning bell.
So, how can parents look for those comprehension issues? Is it just a matter of saying, okay, so you've been doing chemistry today, what have you learned? And seeing what they say, is it as simple as that?
It can, yeah, definitely. Because also, I mean, if your child can't recall, can't remember what they've been doing, then that's it, that could be a sign of a working memory issue anyway. Obviously, you've got to try and cut through the teenager who doesn't really want to tell you, you know.
I was going to say that. Even at the age of five, my five-year-old has a tendency of saying, when I say, what did you do at school today? Nothing. I was like, okay, right. Yeah, I can only imagine it getting worse when he gets to be a teenager. So, yeah, you've got to separate those two issues from each other, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. And obviously on their writing, you know, secondary school, that they'd be doing a lot more writing. So if you're looking in their books, for example, and they just don't seem to have written very much at all, mm-hmm. you know, you'd expect, especially if they're coming up to GCSE, you'd be expecting them to write essays probably 2 or 3 pages long. Mm-hmm. If they're literally writing half a page,
yeah,
that could signify a problem.
Yeah.
Parents' evenings, the kind of things that teachers say would be, oh, it just, you know, they don't try hard enough.
Okay.
They're just not trying, and they might say, "Oh, you know, he really." I'm saying he. It could be he or she. Sorry, I don't mean to gender that one. They might say, "Oh, you know, they really understood that concept. You know, when I was talking to them about it, they absolutely understood it. But then when I got this work in." Yeah. It just doesn't show that they understand it at all, or, you know, they've barely written anything about it. So I think they're lazy.
Yeah. That one other thing that I wonder from what you've read, what I've read that you've written is, do they get more tired than maybe you would expect them to?
Yes, they do. Because obviously their brain is in effect having to work kind of twice as hard at least mm-hmm. as everybody else is to get to the same point.
Yes.
So of course if everybody else can write 3 pages quite easily in say an hour, then a dyslexic child can probably write 1 page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, seeing that. And also when you do a longer piece of writing, because your working memory is working harder anyway just to do the longer piece of writing, spelling is often atrocious.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you don't understand, you know, because they might be able to spell a word, say for example the word could, if you were doing a single word spelling test, they might be able to spell the word could. If you ask them how to spell could, they might be able to tell you verbally. But if you see in a longer piece of writing it's constantly spelled incorrectly, then that's a big indicator that they've got an issue.
Would that incorrect spelling in itself vary? So it might be could, C-U-D, or it might be could, C-O-L-D, like that. Would
oh,
be
yeah.
Fine. But if it's inconsistently wrongly spelt, is that another sign?
Yes, even if it's like correct in some places, wrong in others.
Yeah,
I've seen all kinds of it. I mean, I've got one student who can write that probably about 3 different ways for you, including the right way.
Mm-hmm.
In one piece of writing.
Okay, so those are great. Those are some really good signs that parents of teenagers might be looking out for. But I've also heard from a lot of parents that there seems to be something which I've kind of called dyslexia denial going on in schools, where teachers say that students don't have dyslexia and the families have had to go through some other route other than through the school's special educational needs coordinator or SENCO to kind of get it, you know, taken seriously and paid attention to. Have you got any advice to families about how to deal with this dyslexia denial that can go on in schools?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one actually, and it's definitely becoming quite a large problem. I'm wondering if it's slightly to do with funding actually at the moment, mm-hmm. because obviously if a school identifies an issue, then they may have to pull your child out, perhaps for intervention, like one-to-one or small group. So they've got to provide a member of staff to do that with. They've got to have an appropriate program to use, that kind of thing. So it does seem to be getting worse. Now, you know, I think a bit of a harsh reality that we're dealing with is that if you suspect your child has dyslexia, you are going to have to pay for some kind of an assessment. If the school are in complete denial, always talk to the school first, always make an appointment to meet with the SENCO, mm-hmm. because you know, if the school can do it, will do it, they are a good place to start. But if they completely deny it, they absolutely won't, you know, won't help, won't do any kind of assessments themselves, then you have to go outside and you have to pay for it.
Okay, where do you go then? Where do you go to get that help outside school?
So generally, you've got two levels of things that you can do. You can do a dyslexia screening, which is sort of a slightly more informal, quicker, cheaper way of saying, like looking at what's going on with your child and saying, you know, yeah, there's quite high probability that your child has dyslexia. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes that can be enough to go back to the school with, yeah. And the school we'll start to kind of go, oh, okay, yeah, now we understand why they're doing this, this, and this, and we'll put this in place. So job done, everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you might have to go down the road of getting a formal dyslexia assessment from a qualified, usually educational psychologist. There are some qualified specialist teachers. You'll find a list of them either on the British Dyslexia Association website,
okay,
the PATOS website, which is PATOSS.
PATOSS.
Yeah, PATOS.
And it was the British Dyslexia Association.
Yeah. They hold lists of people qualified to do a formal assessment. Now, when you have a formal assessment, that's saying for definite, you know, yes, your child definitely has dyslexia. Mm-hmm. And then
do they give you any degree of severity? Because, you hear people saying they're very dyslexic or they're mildly dyslexic. Do those tests give you any indication of the severity of the dyslexia?
Yes, they will do, because they basically measure your child's brain, if you like, brain processes against standardized scores. Mm-hmm. So you can see from the standardized score what percentile your child is working within. So, for example, if they're checking visual memory, so in other words, your ability to take learning in through seeing it,
yeah.
They might say, well, your child is only working as well as the lowest 5% of the population.
Okay.
In which case you can take it, that's pretty severe.
Yeah.
Whereas they may, and a lot of dyslexic children actually work at completely the other end, because they're usually quite visual learners. So okay. They may be able to take in learning through like diagrams and what they're seeing, and they're working within the top 95%.
Yeah.
Of the population. Okay. So they do various tests.
So that could be an indicator in itself that they're kind of compensating for their language difficulty by the fact that they're very strong visually. Does that make sense?
Yes, so you can do. Not all are. I mean, you get a real array of results from these standardized tests, yeah, but a fair few are. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, I will put links to the British Dyslexia Association and PATOS in the show notes, so if parents want to have a look at those, they can find the links and progress that if they want to. Okay, Debbie, so what strategies do you recommend to parents to help their children overcome the difficulties that dyslexia brings to them?
Okay, so if you're as a parent are trying to help your child, I would first of all say just focus on whatever is the weakest area for that child. So if reading, for example, is their weakest area, then just concentrate on the reading, because over time everything else will kind of have time to get into place. If a child isn't reading, really, mm-hmm. they're not going to have a lot of success with the writing.
Nice.
So reading, I would do things like making sure your child can chunk words down, okay? So split them up into smaller chunks for them to read them.
So like you said at the beginning with the word sheep, so sh, e, and p.
Yeah, or even like sh, eep. Don't be too precious about how you split them up.
Okay.
Obviously, if you can teach your child how to split words up properly into syllables, then some of the language structure will make more sense.
Is it important, the difference between the syllables and the sounds? Because I know from doing phonics with my two children that the phonemes, I think it's called, like the sh and the e, they blend together to make one single syllable, don't they? So does it matter whether it's in syllables or actually in the individual sounds within the word?
I would say go with what works with your child.
Okay.
Some dyslexics find it just easier to chunk in a certain way. If you can actually teach them how to chunk it properly into syllables, then when you come across things called open syllables, which is things that you get in the words like be, as in like be happy, okay. the long E yeah. happens because it's an open syllable.
Okay.
And open syllables happen, can also occur in words. So if you're not chunking properly into syllables, you might be confused as to why some vowels have their longer sound rather than, sorry, this is a little bit technical. Yeah. I really want to go into the technical bits, but chunking is basically a really good strategy to help somebody read. Teaching them which sounds go with which letters. So if you're looking at sort of vowel digraphs, like an A and an I makes mm-hmm. an A sound. So making sure that you teach your child all of those is extremely helpful. And I found that teaching children to visualise words in their sort of mind's eye can really help.
Explain how that works.
Okay, so if you're, most dyslexic children are quite good at making pictures, and it's the right-hand side of their brain mm-hmm. That works pretty well. It's the right-hand side of your brain that stores pictures. So if you can, basically, if you look up to the left with your eyes mm-hmm. and you can, like, one technique is to air write the letter and say the sounds as you're saying, you know, as you're writing out the word.
So air write with your finger or with your eyes?
Air write with your finger.
Okay.
Look up to the left, hold your hand right up so that you can see it. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then air write a word. So say, for example, you can't spell were, okay, then you'd be looking at it, you'd go W-E-R-E. But yep. you've got to stay looking to the left, all right? So you can't come right across yourself like yep. that. You need, your eyes have got to stay to the left.
Okay, so, you don't track your finger as you're writing it?
No, in fact, you probably want to overwrite where you're doing the W and then do the E and then the R and then the E.
Okay, and why is it that you need to look left?
Because when you look left, you're engaging the right-hand side of your brain.
Okay.
So, and then your brain can store a picture of it.
Yeah.
And it's just another way of storing information for children to recall, perhaps a little bit easier.
This all sounds quite technical. If parents are listening to this and thinking, I need to do these things, but I'm not sure how, have you got resources on your website or anything that we can direct them to help them with this?
Yes, I do have resources. And if anyone wants to know about visualising, I've actually got a help sheet on that. So if you just contact me through my website, I can ping that over to you.
Yeah, or maybe you can give me the link after we finish talking, Debbie, and I can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that. Okay, so there's lots of things that parents can be doing, but I don't think we can go over all those things right now because it sounds like it's a bit difficult. So let's move on. So do you have any advice to parents about how to communicate with schools and teachers about what helps their particular child to learn and achieve? Like, as a parent, how should they be communicating to make that happen?
Yeah, so I think you really always need to have quite a positive stance. I think try and view the schools as somebody that you're working with rather than, trying to work against, or mm-hmm. try not to think they're working against you. It's just that they're trying to deal with large numbers of children mm-hmm. and you're treating your child as an individual. I mean, obviously, you're sort of saying that, you know, the parents have got to become the expert. And I kind of slightly agree with that. As a parent, you've got to get to know your child, because then you've got to be able to tell the school really how they learn. Now, of course, a lot of people will say, gosh, that's the wrong way round. Surely it should be teachers telling me. The reality, I'm afraid, is that you actually have to end up knowing more than the teachers do. Completely. I think she said it. As you said at the beginning, it just isn't covered in teacher training, no. Teaching qualifications at all, no. Unless the teacher seeks it for themselves.
Yeah.
So you should make sure that you have meetings with the school special educational needs coordinators. Yeah. Make them aware of anything you've become aware of that is your child's particular strength. And all schools, as far as I'm aware, do have some kind of card that they produce or some kind of report they produce, and all teachers that then teach your child are supposed to read it, particularly secondary school, but even primary school. So any teacher teaching your child should really be aware of their difficulties and what they should be doing to meet those. Of course, I can point you to a number of parents that say that doesn't happen and you have to constantly email the individual teachers, particularly at secondary school, perhaps more than primary. I think you just have to get over...
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, I'll just pipe in here as a former secondary school teacher. You know, when you're planning over 20 lessons a week and you're maybe seeing over 300 children a week, it's very, very difficult to see each child as an individual and differentiate individually for each of those children. And so anything that can be done at home to overcome, you know, help and support, you know, either by giving information to the teachers or just by kind of breaking it down in a different way when you get home, is going to be hugely beneficial. And I think, again, I'm going to refer people back to that episode with Zoe Short, and I'll put the link in the show notes as to how to create this positive relationship with the school and basically have a realistic expectation of what the school is able to give. And you've already mentioned about funding cuts, and I know a lot of schools have lost a lot of their teaching assistants because of funding cuts and things like that. And I think families, to a certain extent, do just have to be realistic about what they're going to get from school.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, you as a family can view your child as the individual, but as you say, you know, there's no way that a teacher who's seen that many pupils can actually do that. So the more sort of, I say, realistic, the more information you can give them about your child, you know, it all kind of like helps. But just don't be afraid to kind of advocate for your child. Just keep it all very positive. You know, if the child gets sent home some homework that they clearly is just completely beyond them, you know, don't be afraid to kind of email that back to the teacher, you know, feedback. Well, you know, we could do this aspect of it and we've done it in this way. You know, perhaps we've made a mind map rather than an essay because the essay was going to take too long. This is why we've done it. You know, positive relationships all the way through and are really, really helpful.
Communication is just key to it all.
Key, absolutely key.
Okay, moving on to teachers then. You saw that you wrote an absolutely amazing article for the Huffington Post. I think it was in Dyslexia Awareness Week, wasn't it, quite recently?
It was, yes.
And it was kind of addressed as a letter to teachers. And I'll link to it in the show notes as well so that people can go and see that, because it's well worth a read for everybody to understand what dyslexic children are coping with. But from that article, what are the key messages you'd want to give to teachers? Because I know there will be some listening about dyslexic children. Like, if you could give them three of the key things from that article, what would they be?
Okay, so I think if you think a child is being lazy or they're not really trying hard enough, maybe try and think, well, why might that be? It's really trying to take a slightly more thinking approach. I think that would be the absolute key thing to come out of the article. You don't just assume that child is being lazy, is being sort of difficult. There's certain ones where parents said, you know, just because my child might look like they're daydreaming, actually they're trying to process what you've asked them to do. Okay. So don't have a go at them because they might look like they're staring into thin air. The chances are they're just trying to process through the tasks. So I think overall it's just try and look for a reason why perhaps some of this behavior might be happening. And again, it goes back to that, you know, you've got so many pupils in the room.
Yeah.
And yes, there will be some who are daydreaming because frankly they're not doing their work.
Definitely.
And there will be the ones who can't be bothered to write, you know, something down. But I think if you're thinking that all the time about that child, maybe try and look at their notes, try and go to the Senko, find out. And and then, you know, educate yourself really as to why that might be happening.
So it's kind of think the best before you think the worst.
Absolutely.
In those kind of situations. Brilliant.
Yes.
Okay, well, we're drawing to the end now, Debbie. Is there any other advice you'd give to parents before we finish off?
Yeah, I think if you suspect dyslexia, you should go with your gut reaction. Mm-hmm. You know your child the best. You've got the whole picture of them. And I've written many blogs about signs and what to look for in a child who you think is struggling. And if you do think they're struggling, don't let the schools kind of fob you off. Don't let them make you think it's something else. You know, go with your gut reaction, look into it. Because if it is something like dyslexia, then there are some, I probably made them sound quite complicated in the strategies, but there are actually some quite easy things to do with your child, which will help them phenomenally to succeed at school. Dyslexia is not a barrier to success.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that's an important message to leave on, actually. It's kind of a mindset thing and an attitude thing. Like, this is a problem that can be overcome and worked through, and it actually brings many positive attributes with it. So try to view dyslexia as a positive thing rather than a negative thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Completely stay positive about your child. You know, life isn't all about schoolwork. Make sure they're doing plenty of things that they enjoy doing, that they're very good at doing, so that their self-esteem stays up, their self-confidence grows, you know, and just really make sure they understand their strengths, understand why they struggle with certain aspects of schooling. And then I think you'll find you'll bring up a very successful and well-rounded child.
Wonderful. Okay, Debbie. Well, I am sure that certain parents will be looking to contact you, look at your website and even work with you. So can you tell us how they can do that, please?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I've got a website at www.dyslexiadeb.co.uk. Fantastic. I'm also on Facebook, which is just at Dyslexia Deb. Mm-hmm. And I'm also on Twitter, which is at DyslexiaDeb1. And yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone. I'm always very happy to give out, you know, some advice to people. And I have a free Facebook group, which you can find if you go onto my page at Dyslexia Deb, where I give tips and advice out to parents.
Wasn't that a great conversation? I learned so much about dyslexia, and I'm sure I would have been a better teacher in the context of the classroom if I'd known all that as a result of my teacher training. I really hope that you feel able to pass this episode on to anybody else in your life who you think would benefit, and it has helped you today. And I do encourage you to go and check out Debbie's website and read what she's got to say about dyslexia. She's got loads of free blogs, which I know lots of people get loads of value from. There's that Huffington Post article, which I've linked to in the show notes, and there are also sorts of different ways for you to work with her. Okay, I also wanted to bring your attention to my study skills course for students and parents. It's called the Exam Success Formula, and I've mentioned it several times on the podcast recently, but it's running at the moment and getting great feedback. Only this morning, the day of recording, I had an email from one of the parents taking part, and she said, "Thanks, Lucy. However he does next June, you've taken the stress levels in our house down already." And that's just the kind of thing that I love to hear. I promised at the beginning of the course that it would reduce stress and improve communication between parents and students, as well as teach all the study skills and mindset and all that kind of thing that people need to really succeed in their exams. And the course at the moment is delivering on those promises. So I'm going to be offering an early bird sign up for this at the end of November. The course will actually start again on the 20th of January. So if you want to get a discounted price, it's discounted by £50, you need to get on the waiting list, and I've put the link to the information page for the course in the show notes, or you can just Google the Exam Success Formula and you'll find the page, and you can click on one of the big pink buttons and add your name to the waiting list, so you can make use of that £50 off offer. All it remains for me to say today then is thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.